National League for Peace and Freedom show, The Wake Up Call. We'll be back in just a moment here on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro.
Nas got a rifle in his hand, rolling in a bag, then wondering how he got this far. Just another poor boy out to fight a rich man's war. Bobby had an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue to the moment landing Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. A stack of overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now, he's still there, chasing ghosts in thin dry air. Meanwhile, back at home, the fine has come and took his car. He's just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
International League for Peace and Freedom, we bring you issues of the day that affect our community. My name is Emily O'Hare, and I'm here with co-hosts Dick Paddock and Lori Hoyt, and with our guest that Lori will present to you.
Okay, hi everybody. We're glad to be here. The weather being a little cooler, we're feeling more energetic. And we have two energetic guests with us that are doing a lot to make this a better world, we hope and pray. Okay, we have John Ewer, an old friend, and we have Howard Matchinger. And both of them are going to be talking about issues of war and peace and going back as far as Vietnam and things that are happening now, because it's certainly out in the forefront again, unfortunately. So welcome to the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom Wake Up Call. We're glad to have you.
Thank you, Lori.
To be here.
Okay, so who wants to go first? Maybe Howard. You're new here, and we're glad to have you.
I guess we're here to talk about the Veterans for Peace project called Full Disclosure Toward an Honest Commemoration of the American War in Vietnam. And we're approaching the 50th anniversary of a lot of events around what we call the American War in Vietnam, because in America they call it the Vietnam War, and in Vietnam they call it the American War, which came after the French War. Anyway, 1965, 50 years ago, was the year of prime escalation of the war, and when most Americans became aware of Vietnam as a country. Along with this, the Pentagon, Congress passed a bill a couple of years ago to do a 13-year commemoration of the war. And we in Veterans for Peace have a slightly different take on the war than the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And so we felt it was necessary to organize and help inspire an honest reckoning with what actually went on in the war, because our political leaders don't seem to have absorbed what we think are the important lessons of the war. And as we're here today, we see that the instinct to respond to any political crisis is to bomb. Mm-hmm. It makes thinking about the meaning of Vietnam more relevant than ever. We had events, a few events around the country on the anniversary of the 50th anniversary of the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And for those of you who don't know about the Gulf of Tonkin, there were two supposed attacks on U.S. ships in the Gulf of Tonkin, which is right next to North Vietnam. Now, let me just do a little context building here. The war that happened in Vietnam was the continuation of a war that the Vietnamese launched against the French so that they would no longer be colonized. That war was interrupted briefly when the country was divided in two parts. There was supposed to be an election in 1956 to reunite the country. That election never happened. Eisenhower, who was president at the time, was famously quoted as saying that we couldn't have the election because we know that the leader from the North Vietnamese, Ho Chi Minh, would have won 80% of the vote in a fair election. So the United States decided that there shouldn't be any election. And so then the war picked up again in 1959 and on, and the U.S. got increasingly involved. So the Gulf of Tonkin was the equivalent of weapons of mass destruction. It was the excuse for the U.S. to launch war on another country and another people. So that was last August was the 50th anniversary of that. And by January or February of the next year, U.S. started to put boots on the ground, as the military likes to put it. And the war, by the end of 1965, there were over 100,000 troops. At the height of the war in 1968, there were over 500,000 U.S. troops in Vietnam.
Yeah, I think I'm so glad you're giving us a brief context and a little history, because there's a lot of young people, you know, hear about it, really know nothing much about it. And it makes you be aware that it started out with Kennedy putting a few, or maybe before him, I'm not sure, putting a few, was it observers and
advisors?
Advisors. And then Johnson got in, and it really became his war.
American involvement starts with the French War, where we're bankrolling 80% of the expenses of the French. Yeah. You know, the first anti-war action of Americans took place in 1945 when Navy personnel landed in Hanoi and were shocked to find the Japanese, who had recently surrendered, in charge there because Britain was concerned to keep the Vietnamese under control, and the Japanese were in charge. And there was a petition by these Navy sailors questioning this as policy. So that's really the first anti-war action by an American. It's 1945.
You know, it's never so bad that it can't be worse. The more you learn, the more it's shocking. That is shocking. So thank you for that history, because that was a neo-colonial war. They were trying to win their freedom from the French, and Ho Chi Minh was their George Washington. And wasn't a promise made that that they could have that election? Wasn't there some promise made?
Well, that was the terms. There was a conference in Geneva.
Okay, yeah.
The Vietnamese defeated the French at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954, which was one of the most important battles of the 20th century, because a colonized people defeated, the colonizers. And in fact, you can see Malcolm X talking about the significance for people of color of that victory. So as a result of that victory, there was a conference in Geneva. And in fact, the Vietnamese resistance compromised on allowing the country to be divided under pressure from the Russians and the Chinese. But what they thought they got was the right to have elections in 1956.
Uh-huh.
So that was part of the Geneva Agreement, but it never happened.
Okay. Another promise not kept. Quite a long history of that. So that brings us to where then? Now that you've given us the context. So we started talking about this is going to be the 50th anniversary, and the Pentagon wanted to have this 13-year commemoration, or what were they going to do?
Well, they've had events. Last year they had an event at the Texas State Fair.
Okay.
And if you look, you know, we have a website at www.vietnamfulldisclosure.org. www.vietnamfulldisclosure.org. And there's actually a link to the Pentagon's website. There's actually a lot of more interesting material than that on the website, but there is a link there, and you can go there and see what they're up to. But so far, you know, they have a chronology. We also have a chronology on the website, and it's basically the goal of it is to honor the valor of the soldiers who fought there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was valor in Vietnam on both sides, but the real question is, why was the U.S. there? What was it doing?
Mm-hmm.
And what was the price of the war that the Vietnamese had to pay? There were, you know, somewhere between 3 and 4 million deaths due to the war, over half of them civilian. There was use of chemical weapons, napalm, bombing more extensive than in World War II by the Americans. So, you know, it's, I think what the Pentagon wants to do, first of all, it wants to legitimize further wars and do that, but they want to do this by wiping out the actual history of the war.
Of what happened and exploiting us having feelings for the people who were stuck there fighting in the jungle. And try to gloss over what was actually going on, whitewash it.
When I've spoken, I've compared this to Woodrow Wilson speaking at the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, where he honors the veterans without mentioning slavery or African Americans. And, of course, that coincided with – I mean, Wilson was the first president to show a movie at the White House, and it was Birth of a Nation – and his friends were scholars who developed this interpretation of Reconstruction, which was totally about black people being corrupt and lazy and so on. So this attempt to rewrite the meanings of wars has happened before, and Wilson was largely successful. That narrative of the Civil War and Reconstruction dominated academic history until the Civil Rights Movement. So we want to prevent that from happening, and we think it's really important that, you know, when the war in Iraq started, I was teaching, and
are you a historian, Howard?
I'm not an official historian, no.
Just by love of history.
And one of my students said to me, he said, George W. Bush knows things that you don't know. And my response was, I'd heard that before. I heard it during the Vietnam War. And in fact, just like in the Vietnam War, activists who were concerned about this knew more about what was going on than the government because the war machine went in with the fantasy that American technology could conquer everything. This fantasy still exists.
Yes, it does.
And that, in fact, there were legitimate political issues that the resistance had, people the Americans had no ear for. They thought that the Vietnamese were agents of the Chinese when the Vietnamese carved their whole national identity in resisting the Chinese over 1,000 years. One of the things that's really important is that the war exists in American consciousness as kind of a figment of American imagination. In other words, it was a crisis for Americans. There's rarely any movie that actually about the war that has Vietnamese who talk or who talk intelligently about what's going on. They're all about Americans freaking out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the core problem, is the inability of our culture to recognize the humanity, the reality, and the power of the people in Vietnam or any place else that we seem to have an inclination to bomb. And I think that's the first lesson, is that the Vietnamese were human beings, fully capable of fighting and defeating the American military, and that, you know, that I don't think when they start a war, they demonize the other side. And because you couldn't do the kinds of things they do in war to people you consider human beings.
Yeah, and that's the war that we've made this big thing about, chemical use of chemical weapons in Syria, which is terrible. But we were in the forefront of that in Vietnam, and a lot of our military, along with the Vietnamese, have suffered the effects of Agent Orange. We use chemical warfare, and I remember being, I was very naive politically then, and started as an older person going to school at UNC, and I'd hear these young people talking about napalm, and I thought, our country wouldn't do that. I just thought, you know, that, no. And then it comes out shortly after in the regular newspaper, not just, you know, lefty kids talking about it, about the use of napalm, and that was when I just said, that's it. You know, our country's doing that. That is the most horrible thing. And so began a long journey of really paying attention to what our government's doing and not doing.
One of the things that's important is that there are projects now that deal with the legacy of Agent Orange in Vietnam, and as well as projects that deal with the huge amount of unexploded ordnance. Again, you can go to our website and find out information about all that. I mean, the other thing that's left out of the history on the whole is the fact that the American Army more and more didn't want to fight in Vietnam. And the resistance of the veterans, this has been totally, and this is one thing that the commemoration doesn't want to deal with at all, was the tremendous resistance inside the military, unprecedented in American history, to this war.
Now, the resistance, was this the guys actually doing the fighting, or was this within the ranks of the officers also?
Well, it gets to, it's interesting. It's you see in the end, even people engaged in the air war refusing to fly.
Really?
A lot of the antagonists, you know, there was also contradictions inside the military. There's a famous article for the Armed Forces Journal written in 1971 by Colonel Heinel, in which he deplores the collapse of the armed forces. He's very worried about this, including dozens and dozens of incidents of soldiers fragging their officers who they think are not taking their safety into sufficient consideration.
Fragging
means is where you take a grenade, and instead of throwing it at the enemy, you throw it at one of your officers.
And kill them.
Well, whatever.
Whatever happens.
Whatever the consequence of
that.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just to send a message, and you don't kill the person.
Yeah. I remember that. That was in the papers. I mean, and that's when there was huge resistance. And for some time afterwards, I mean, the military saw that as a huge defeat. But now enough time has passed that they're trying to sort of change the narrative.
Well, General Petraeus's PhD dissertation at Princeton was on how to do better than in Vietnam. So, yes, the military's been haunted by this.
Yes.
And every war, they're trying to cure the Vietnam, what they call the Vietnam syndrome.
Yeah. And part of that seems to be, let's have war without the draft, because the draft certainly galvanized a lot of young people to fight that war, because a lot of them were under threat. And so since then, I don't think we've had a draft.
Yeah, I think the ruling circles and the military have learned basically public relations lessons from the war rather than the lessons we're trying to talk about. So you don't get pictures of body bags coming home. You embed the journalists so they don't have an independent perspective. You don't have a draft. So they've figured out how to manage the war. And the other thing they've done—
To keep us all quiet.
Right.
And
well, the other thing they've done, which I think is even more powerful, and it's part of the militarization of the society, is that, and this was very important during the Iraq War, which is they made the issue rather than is this war right or wrong, what's the effect going to be the effect on the Iraqi people, whether people who protested this honored our soldiers enough. And this was based on a myth that anti-war protesters spat on soldiers returning, which actually makes no sense because very rarely did a soldier come to a civilian airport. But aside from all that, the notion was that this was anti-soldier. Mm-hmm. And I think to some extent, the anti-war movement in the Iraq War lost sight of that the war, you had to talk about who we were attacking. You had to build a human connection with them. We could have done better on that in the anti-war movement in Vietnam, but we had some success. And the issue isn't, you know, do you cross the soldiers? We've always felt like we don't want to risk soldiers in wars that are oppressive and make no sense for the American people. That's the best way to be pro-soldier, mm-hmm. not to do this kind of PR buildup that gets sponsored all the time. And this is, of course, what the Pentagon's depending upon in terms of this commemoration, that people wanting to honor soldiers' bravery will overwhelm actually thinking about what these wars were about.
Yeah. And you mentioned the 2 or 3 million people being killed. I mean, that's a staggering number, and many of them, most of them probably civilians.
At least 2 million civilians. I mean, it's hard to get the numbers exactly right, but that's the general consensus.
Well, and especially who's a civilian and who's a fighter when it's on your land, just like in the Civil War in this country, when the war comes right into your town, you're trying to defend yourself. So are you a civilian or a combatant? You're kind of forced to be maybe both at that same time. But the Vietnamese people have had the aftermath of how many births were children being born disfigured and with birth defects from the lingering effects of the chemicals, Agent Orange.
Well, soldiers have gotten some relief, but of course...
It took a long time, though.
It took a long time, but of course, the Agent Orange was sprayed on the Vietnamese.
Yes.
And so the question of giving them relief, there have been lawsuits and so on, so far with no success, but people are trying to bring this to bear. You know, when you see... A deformed child, it's very hard to prove, oh, this happened because of this. But it's clear that the spraying of Agent Orange, we know it's carcinogenic. Dioxin is one of the most carcinogenic substances. And so there is a little – the U.S. has finally set up an Agent Orange clearing – project in Da Nang, but there are also many more sites that are hot spots for mm-hmm. Agent Orange that are still a problem mm-hmm. for Vietnamese people.
Mm-hmm. So you have this project. What is the name of your project again?
It's called Full Disclosure.
Full Disclosure.
Toward an honest commemoration of the American War in Vietnam.
Full Disclosure. So how is that going? Is this all over the country or?
Yeah, we're trying. We just, you want to talk a little bit about the convention maybe?
Howie's been talking, and now here comes John.
Lori, Howie is the principal author of this project.
Okay.
It began through our local chapter of Veterans for Peace.
So both of you are veterans?
No, I'm not a veteran. I'm an associate member.
An associate member.
Which is a status for people who aren't. I call myself a veteran of the anti-war movement.
Good for you. Good for you.
And the project was launched nationally at our National Convention of Veterans for Peace in Madison, Wisconsin, last August. So we've been working chiefly under Howie's leadership direction, but have garnered hundreds of signatures of support for this effort that has become both national and international, with support from the Veterans for Peace chapter in Vietnam. Support from the Project Renew, which deals with unexploded ordnance in Vietnam. And we're encouraged by the level of support, particularly among veterans across the U.S.
So that started what, last year? I'm sorry.
It was officially announced at our national convention August in Madison, Wisconsin. Our convention this year was held July 23rd through the 27th in Asheville. It was a wonderful convention. We had 350 veterans and friends attend. We had a table for the full disclosure campaign and a plenary session that drew about 100 people. That was one of three simultaneous plenaries. A lot of interest, a lot of support, a lot of encouragement for this project, with the understanding that our government still is capable of lying to us. Some people don't know about Operation Northwoods, which was a scheme concocted in the early 60s by the Pentagon to take down a U.S. jet airliner and blame it on the Cubans and use it as a casus belli to invade Cuba. Of course, it was secret for decades, but it eventually leaked out.
When did it leak out?
Well, I'm not sure exactly when it became public knowledge, but it was certainly decades after the actual occurrence in 1961.
And this was when again that they were...
Early 1960s.
Oh, my God. And so this is going to be a jetliner with people in it.
Right. So it's really difficult to imagine that this was the one and only instance that the U.S. government was concocting false flag operations and dishonesty to sell the U.S. public on war. We know that the Gulf of Tonkin incident and subsequent resolution was a hoax and a fraud, just as we know now.
Yeah, we should make that clear. It was a hoax.
There was an incident. The U.S. had been targeting areas along the coast of the Gulf of Tonkin. And so there was an incident on August 2nd. And then what got Johnson to push for the resolution that wasn't a declaration of war, but basically in reality that's what it was an incident on August 4th, which did not happen. And that's very clear. All historians agree. That there was nothing happened on August 4th.
So this resolution was based on a hoax and a lie. And I guess Congress was lied to, and then it wasn't until afterwards that...
Congress was lied to, just as Congress was lied to and the American people in Iraq with claims of weapons of mass destruction that the government had every reason to know did not exist, yet they persisted with selling this fear to the American people.
So the drums of war are beating again. We got to be a little careful with what's really what's true and what's not true.
One of the in fact, the only State Department representative to resign in protest of U.S. policy in Afghanistan is a two-tour Iraq War veteran, former Marine Captain Matthew Ho, who resigned in 2009 in protest of the war policies, U.S. war policies in Afghanistan. And Matthew has been writing quite prodigiously in recent days and weeks. He was one of our keynote speakers at our convention in Asheville to say that there will be no good that would come from U.S. military action in Syria and in Iraq. That he knows of no instance where U.S. military intervention has had the effect of quelling such violence in modern history.
And also, the way the media talks about this is that there's no connection between ISIS or ISIL and what the American war in Iraq, which helped create the conditions for them, including the hardening of sectarian lines in Iraq, which the U.S. reinforced in many multiple ways.
Deliberately.
And so the reason that ISIS has power, I don't think is the 5,000 to 10,000 fighters it has. One military reason is all the hardware they've seized from the Iraqi army, which was U.S. supplied. But more fundamentally is that they've built a coalition with Sunnis in the various towns in northern and western Iraq who are upset with the government's treatment of all Sunnis. And this is the government that we installed.
And it kept saying, please have a government that includes everybody, but it didn't happen. We are getting signals that it's time for a station break. Emily?
We had to interrupt this very interesting conversation to take a break. You're listening to WILF's Wake Up Call, WCOM-LP 103.5 FM. If you're having difficulty, you can stream us live on WCOMFM.org. Wake Up Call is underwritten by Internationalist Bookstore. They are currently at 405 West Franklin Street in Chapel Hill, soon to move to Lloyd Street in Carrboro. I have one announcement, and that is there will be a demonstration in support of the People's Climate March, which is taking place in New York City. And this demonstration is organized by the United Church of Chapel Hill. It will be held at the Peace and Justice Plaza. That's at the old post office on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. It will be held on Sunday, September 21st, from 2 to 3.
And I hope a lot of people come. Some of us are going to be, or some of our friends will be going to New York. This is going to be a big conference because the UN has come out with a report. And maybe you could, Howie, maybe just mention
Latest report that came out of the UN was that between 2012 and 2013, the carbon emissions went up more than any time, any other recorded year. So we can see that the priorities of our political leaders are quite wrongheaded, and things are getting worse rather than getting better. Mm-hmm. And there's not much time to deal with this. And of course, waging war also is no way to minimize carbon emissions, to say the least.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So this is going to be a huge march in New York. My sister lives on Long Island. She's a nun. And let me tell you, the nuns have been working really hard in this. A lot of nuns have made this like their big mission for the year. Some of them have NGO status at the UN, as does the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. So a lot of people are working very hard to mobilize people to get the word out what danger we're in, and to put pressure on our political leaders to get off their duff and start doing something serious about this, because that is a very upsetting and depressing piece of information that in just last year, it's gotten worse, not better, in spite of, you know, people talking about trying this and doing that. It's not enough. And we've got a long ways to go, and our kids and our grandkids are in danger, as well as for us too. It's happening much faster than the scientists even thought it was. It's happening very quickly. So go to New York if you can on the 21st, but if you can't, come on up to the Peace and Justice Plaza, and let's hope we get a good turnout. Emily?
You can bring signs, and there will be speeches there.
Yes, so we can get ourselves inspired to start putting pressure, meeting with our elected representatives. So we're going to go back to war and peace, and we're concentrating right now mostly about the Vietnam War and Howard's spearheading a full disclosure campaign, because it's always the governmental forces trying to whitewash things and change the narrative. And that's interesting, that parallel you made with the Civil War and the damage that did to change the narrative about Reconstruction and blaming the pangs of Reconstruction on the African American people and not on the forces that wanted to get their power back and kept them intimidated.
Well, received wisdom has it that the winners write the history of wars, but I think the Civil War was an exception to that, where the Confederacy wrote most of the history of the war. And I think what the Pentagon is trying to replicate, that thing where the U.S. military, which lost in Vietnam, wants to rewrite that history. I think they'll have a harder time, but that's only if there's a real response.
Yes.
Otherwise, they could have their way.
Yes.
And Lori, the effort to rewrite the history and change the narrative of the war in Vietnam isn't just beginning with this new Pentagon commemoration. As a former teacher, Howie is well familiar with how the teaching of history in since the Vietnam War has altered perspectives, and that the demographic in the United States that is most approving of the war in Vietnam are young people who weren't even born at that time, based
Your
on
kid.
What they read in their history books.
In their history books. So, yeah, what are they teaching in high school and in college about Vietnam?
Well, I did a little survey of high school textbooks, and what's avoided, and there's better and worse treatments, but what's generally avoided is the moral issues about the war.
Mm-hmm.
So opposition in one textbook was based on the fact that the economy was hurt by the war, or that the U.S. was losing, both of which are true and important, that the war didn't help the economy, as many people argue. But the heart of anti-war activism had to do with an understanding that the war was wrong and not just, you know, it didn't come out of a cost-benefit analysis like the pundits like to use. And that is pretty much absent from that the United States might be wrong is an important thing that needs to be communicated.
Yes, it does.
And, you know, I don't really expect the textbooks, which after all have to pass through the Texas board of that evaluates textbooks, and we can go into what their politics are. But I do expect an acknowledgement that this was an issue that was raised by people who opposed the war, and that it wasn't not that self-interest was bad, but it wasn't just a bunch of students who didn't want to get drafted. And I mean, that's what I was saying before about the whole media. I saw the CNN treatment of the Vietnam War, and its theme was that Johnson was a Shakespearean tragedy whose attempt at grand social reform was lost on the battlefield of Vietnam. And I don't even think they had Ho Chi Minh pictured in that whole, if memory serves. But there was certainly no sense of the Vietnamese as people again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's all a concoction of the American imagination, what mm-hmm. went on there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first thing in terms of making us citizens of the world, is to understand our relationship and our interconnection with other people. And, you know, in Martin Luther King's incredible anti-war speech, which he gave a year before he was assassinated, he talks a lot about the connections amongst people. And, you know, he's spent his political life preaching nonviolence. And then young people would say to him, well, what about Vietnam? They're telling us to be nonviolent. They're not nonviolent in Vietnam. And that was part of what got him mm-hmm. to take a strong stance against Vietnam, which he paid a tremendous price for politically. The New York Times chastised him sort of, you don't know your place.
I remember that. I remember that. And even though the civil rights leaders, we got to concentrate on the civil rights.
Well, the establishment civil rights movement, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, mm-hmm. as early as 1965, came out very strongly mm-hmm. against the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just read you this quote from Malcolm X.
Please.
Which he said in January of 1965, just a month before he was assassinated, his comment on the war was, it shows the real ignorance of those who control the American power structure. If France, with all types of heavy arms, as deeply entrenched as she was in what was called Indochina, couldn't stay there, I don't see how anybody in their right mind can think that the U.S. can get in there. It's impossible. shows her ignorance, her blindness, her lack of foresight and hindsight, and her complete defeat in South Vietnam is only a matter of time. Now, if we look at the media, we know that he wouldn't have been, if he had lived, he wouldn't have been invited to speak about the next war, because the only people who appear on the media are people who are for the Iraq War, mm-hmm. and not any of the critics who turn out to be right about it, mm-hmm. but the media doesn't consider them credible. Mm-hmm. That's as clear a statement about what was going to happen in Vietnam as you could have read anywhere in the world.
And that was, you said, in 65.
In 65, as the U.S. was gearing up.
Just as we were gearing up, and mm-hmm. what was the year we got out, 70 what?
Well, 70. We withdrew in 73. 75. There wasn't the war didn't end until 75.
Yeah. And so he was very prescient. I mean, he really was a prophet, I mean, because a lot of people would have thought, oh, who really buy into American exceptionalism and technology, and, you know, here's these little people who don't have this kind of technology, and we'll go in but you're right, we didn't pay attention. The French, look what the French, my God, they got kicked out of Haiti by the slaves, kicked out of Vietnam. You know, and we do the same thing again in Afghanistan. The Russians couldn't make it there, and somehow we thought we had some special magic.
Yeah, another thing that people don't talk about Vietnam is the question of nuclear weapons. And because luckily nuclear weapons were not used, at least they weren't dropped. They were used, in fact, because in Nixon had this madman theory, which he thought would intimidate the Vietnamese. And he, in his understanding, is that Eisenhower had threatened the use of nuclear weapons, which is what he claimed brought the Koreans, North Koreans, to the table and led to an armistice in Korea in 1953. So Nixon threatened, the Vietnamese say that during the war, they were threatened 13 times with the use of nuclear weapons. Now, threatening use of nuclear weapons is a use of nuclear weapons. It's obviously not as bad as actually using them, but it's an important use.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there were, and it was a veteran who actually, who was guarding nuclear weapons, who exposed this, that they actually put in the air in 69 number of B-52 bombs that were bombers that had nuclear weapons on them. Now, who knows what Nixon would have done, but what seems to have stopped him, and this is very important, were the demonstrations that happened in November 69, where hundreds of thousands of Americans organized against the war. And this was in concert with demonstrations all around the war, because the anti-war movement was not purely an American phenomenon. It was an international movement all over the world. And if you talk to people who came of age in that period who have political consciousness, they all remember participating in anti-war, whether in Algeria mm-hmm. or Venezuela or,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the strength and power of those demonstrations, it's pretty clear, convinced Nixon that if he used nuclear weapons, the U.S. would even be more isolated than it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we had those demonstrations, no one was conscious that this was being contemplated at the time. People were just saying, oh, God, Nixon's president. We want the war to end.
Yeah.
And so I think when people stand up for what's important, they don't know what they're affecting always. They're preventing
yeah.
things that they don't know about that are being contemplated mm-hmm. by these lunatics in power, because I use the word lunatics because anyone who contemplates the use of nuclear weapons qualifies as a lunatic.
Howie, that is such an important thing you said, because so many people and people I know will say, oh, that's nice that you're doing that. You know, you think it's not going to do any good, but, you know, almost like patting you on the head, you know, go out and demonstrate, go to a protest, because they don't think it's going to make any difference. And you can try to tell them, but that's such an important point. You go out there in the hopes it's going to make a difference because you have to do it. because you're so morally outraged. But that's like such an important thing that you just said, because sometimes you're having an effect about some dastardly thing that you didn't even know was going to happen, but that maybe your presence helped prevent it.
Well, what they've succeeded in is building a kind of cynicism about public life.
Yes.
That's very powerful. And, you know, I mean, and evidence for that is how broken the political system is.
Yes.
I mean, the political system is broken.
Absolutely.
But the question is whether you can, you know, build your own gated community to survive that, or whether, I mean, and again, the climate change issue is so profound here because it's hard to build a gate against climate change, even though I think people have fantasies that they can do that. And I think that what's on us is they've been brilliant about building that kind of cynicism and diverting people from that. I mean, I remember a visit of South African students when I was teaching high school, and the South Africans, and they went to a student government meeting, which had about 100 students there. And they asked, the South Africans asked how many people read a newspaper. And that was before the internet. So, and out of 100 students, one kid raised their hand. And these were the kids in student government. But student government wasn't about civic empowerment, but really about something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at this point, with a broken political system, it's on us to figure out forms of political empowerment because, as I was saying about nuclear weapons, these people live in a strange world where that's a possibility.
Yes.
And they think that they can resolve political and social problems through Ferguson police forces or bombing people. And that's – history is pretty clear on that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know – we're either in this together or we're not, and we have to revivify that kind of notion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their biggest victory over us since the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, John.
I'd like to support Howie's point here.
Yeah.
Peace Action historian Lawrence Whitner, now retired from University of New York at Albany, began his career as a historian in the early 60s with the premise that the peace movement had failed to...
And what was his name?
Lawrence Whitner, W-I-T-T-N-E-R.
Okay.
Larry Whitner began his research with the premise that the peace movement had failed, and certainly failed to eliminate nuclear weapons. But in the course of his multi-decades-long research, he came to exactly the opposite conclusion, that the peace movement is why we're still here.
And, wow.
And why we still have an opportunity to resist.
And we need to get that word out, you know, if people realize that there is power in numbers.
That's Larry's, one of his essays is titled, actually, How the Peace Movement Saved the World. But another encouraging issue has to do with the emergence of young leaders and young activists. I don't know if you were with the Raging Grannies last September in Raleigh when I Matter Youth North Carolina staged a wonderful march and rally at the state capitol, March for the Planet, that was organized by 11-year-old Hallie Turner with I Matter Youth North Carolina. We recognized I Matter Youth North Carolina just 2 weeks ago with our North Carolina Peace Action Student Peacemaker Award, recognizing the young activists in their teens and even preteens that at least have so far avoided the contagion of the cynicism of which Howie was just speaking.
Yeah.
They're not yet aware of their powerlessness, so-called. And to see them organizing, Hallie and her parents and grandparents are going to be going to New York City next weekend for the People's Climate March on the 21st. There are going to be actions all over the world on September 21st, which is also the International Day of Peace. We have a...
Oh, that part I didn't know. Is that...
Yes, International Day of Peace on September 21st.
Okay.
So the peace movement is building the People's Climate March as a peace and justice and climate march in New York City.
And is this also coincidental with the UN releasing their report on climate change?
When was that's it? Coincidental. That's
the report has been already released, or?
Yeah, I'm sure. The March is right before the global summit.
Oh, okay.
So there's going to be a lot of stuff coming out there.
Okay.
And there's going to be a lot happening here in North Carolina. The first annual Southport Peace Day is being supported by the mayor of Southport, launching what they intend to be a annual event from here on out.
Southport down by the beach.
Right.
That'd be doubly good to go to.
I'll be there at Southport on the 21st. Okay. Wilmington is celebrating its 8th annual International Day of Peace. Asheville is celebrating at UNC Asheville Peace Day, which is being billed as a large event in Asheville.
Have we been having it here, or is this? I know the United Church of Christ, or I'm not sure they call it that, or the United Church of Chapel Hill. That I know they're one of the organizers for it here, but is this the first time here? Or, you know, I wonder what's been happening in Chapel Hill.
Well, we've been having events around the Triangle in Raleigh and Durham, not so much in Chapel Hill.
Okay,
I think there's been an emphasis in Chapel Hill, Carrboro to have observances commemorating Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In August. I think the International Day of Peace observance is kind of a new phenomenon here, but I think it's a good one.
It's a good one.
Burlington in Alamance County, Greensboro, a major event in Charlotte on September.
This one in Burlington?
Yes, on September 21st.
Do you know where in Burlington?
I can share it with you.
Yeah.
I don't have it right
in front
of me. I have
a daughter, Liz and Graham, and she feels kind of out of things. You know, they are a little far away. And
in Burlington, Alamance Peace Action will be showing the film pictures from a Hiroshima schoolyard, which is an extraordinary story that there was a school in Hiroshima where the students were on a field trip, and their school was destroyed in the bombing of Hiroshima. But the students survived. And All Souls Church in Washington, D.C. found out about this basically homeless school population in Hiroshima, and so they took a collection and they sent them school supplies and art supplies. And these young children in Hiroshima sent back the most marvelous collection of children's artwork that was recently found in the attic of this church. So some of the church members went to Hiroshima and actually were able to meet with the artists now in their 70s.
Oh, my gosh.
Really extraordinary story of reconciliation.
That is a beautiful story. And Emily's a retired, just recently retired teacher with little kids, so I can see her really emotionally.
Very emotional.
Yeah. So in Burlington, I'll have to tell my daughter that she doesn't have to come charging down to Chapel Hill. She can go to something in her home community, which she'd love. Yeah. So you don't know where in Burlington it will be.
It's at one of the churches in Burlington.
Okay.
I'll give you a phone call and let you know.
Okay. So that is, so all over North Carolina, from the beach to the mountains, there are going to be people really paying attention and using their people power to let our elected leaders know that we are paying attention, that we know what's going on, and we want to survive.
And there are a lot of organizations, a lot of websites. Pathways to Peace is one. Peace One Day is another. Peace One Day is a story of Jeremy Gillies' efforts to get the United Nations to actually create a UN International Day of Peace.
So this will be all over the
story.
World.
Yes, this is definitely a global event.
Yeah. A global event. That is really exciting. Because I remember, wasn't it around before, after 9/11 and before we started bombing, that there were these huge peace marches all over the world?
Well, February 15th of 2003 was the largest ever global effort to end a war before it began.
Yeah,
February 15th
that's the time before it gets started.
Tens of millions of people marched on every continent.
So here we are in a similar situation as we speak. And
as we speak.
We saw that when the move to attack Syria came up, there was a general negative reaction, which cornered and kept them from doing that. But it seems like the media has whipped up a frenzy now, and a huge proportion of Americans are going to support bombing in Iraq and Syria. And I think it's particularly important that people be heard now mm-hmm. in pushing back against this. Mm-hmm. And the social pressure not to do that is going to be strong. Mm-hmm. But I think this will end up compounding the problems we have in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And if you want to follow closely on events of Iraq, I'd recommend the blog of Juan Cole, C-O-L-E,
oh, yes.
As
yes.
one of the best, most informed sources of information on this.
Okay.
Especially in the last few days, he's had some very interesting posts.
Okay. So we should, to our listeners.
He's on Chris Hayes' show night before last, I think.
Was he? Okay. So we have 5 more minutes to wrap up.
Lori, if I may add, sure. I agree with Howie that Juan Cole, who happens to also be from my Department of History at the University of Michigan, is a very reliable source, as is Matthew Ho, former State Department official.
What was the one he said? Juan Cole, and then what was the next thing?
Matthew Ho.
Okay.
And for locally here in Chapel Hill Carborough, our Congressmember, 4th District Representative David Price, is speaking at 1 o'clock at Carol Woods this Monday.
Okay.
September 15th.
What stand has he taken, do you know?
I haven't heard, Howard. I don't know if you have.
Well, you know, we had this demonstration before the Iraq War in front of his office, and he ended up voting against the war, which I think is a vote he never regretted, even though before the demonstration word was he was going to vote for the war. So maybe he's movable. We should find out.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So he'll be speaking at Carol Woods up on Weaver Dairy Road at 1 o'clock on Monday, September 15th.
That's Elders for Peace, right?
That's Elders for Peace.
Okay, well, I'll have to try to get there and hope that there's a huge turnout and he gets to realize that the voters are paying attention to what he says and does.
And Elders for Peace is inviting submission of questions to share with David Price before Monday so he can actually have some time to consider possible responses to them.
Yeah, okay. I just don't want to forget before we close, because all of a sudden at the last minute time slips by. We're going to want to show our people power. It's really important that we get out the vote. This may sound like one of the more boring things, but it's totally essential. And right now is the time to try to get voters registered. A lot of voters in a non-presidential election year, that's what happened in 2010. You know, Obama got elected, and people kind of sat on their hands. Oh, we just did this great thing, and we are paying such a price for that in this state and in, around the country. So if you want to have some change right in this state, the senatorial election is totally crucial. Whether you like Kay Hagan or not, this is not whether it's Democrat or Republican, but if you want to have a chance to have in this country, that we can keep control of the Senate's going to be really important. So please, if you want to get into registering voters, you can call Diane Robertson at 919-219-1600. Diane has been spearheading, going around training people, giving talks. If you want somebody to come talk at your church or your group, we only have until October 10th for registration. And we only have 1 week. They've cut it shorter because, of course, those in power don't want that many people coming out to vote. They want to keep it as curtailed as they can. So we have a short window of time to register as many voters as we can. Which a statistic that really surprised me, here in Chapel Hill, there's about a 40 to 50% turnover every year, because it's a transient community, people coming into school, teaching, leaving. And so there's a lot of people who maybe not even thinking of getting registered in their new home. They got a lot of other things on their mind. So people have been going out to the farmer's market. There's going to be phone banking. So if anybody wants to pitch in and help, call Diane Robertson, 919-219-1600. Okay, we got that in September 21st. I want to thank our guests, but do we have a few minutes?
No, we have 10 seconds.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, Howard Metzinger and John Ewer.
Thank